Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Coutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and honored to have with us Professor Robin Pryor. Professor Pryor is professorial fellow at the University of Adelaide. He is one of the leading historians of the British experience of the two world wars of the 20th century. And today we are discussing his latest book, Conquer We Must, A Military History of Britain, 1914 to 1945, published by Yale University Press. Welcome, Professor Pryor.
Thank you very much, Charles.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
There are two theses, really, in the book. The first, and this goes to the title, Conquer We Must, was that once Britain had gone to war, both in 1914 and 1939, on both occasions, I must say, gone to war rather reluctantly. But once at war, it was the implacable nature of their resistance, of their prosecution of the war to the bitter end in both cases, struck me as interesting in a liberal state, a liberal democracy. So that's the first thesis. The second thesis is, what role did politicians trying to direct this war play in a liberal democracy as against the military? What were their relations like? How did they manage to do it? What happened in a liberal state where the ultimate arbiters of what happens are the politicians? What happens when they disagreed with the military, and what happened actually when they agreed? So they're the two theses of the book.
Would it be correct to say that you still adhere to what one may describe as the neo-Fisherite thesis of German prime responsibility for the outbreak of the Great War?
Yes, I do. I think Fisher got many of the details wrong, given the archival work that he couldn't possibly do. He got a lot right, though. And I think what he got right was the determination of the German state to go to war in 1914, really whatever the circumstances applied. The ostensible reason to support Austria, but their first major action, the invasion of Belgium and France. It's hard to get around that.
How prepared was the BEF for the war that was fought in 1914 to 1918?
Look, in some ways, it was a well-trained group, a small army, 140-odd thousand. They were well-trained. They were fully motorized, the only army in 1914 to be so. But the problem was they were, in a way, well-trained to fight the Boer War, the South African War, the last war that they'd fought in. What they found in 1914 very rapidly was that this was a different kind of war. This was a war dominated by machines in the form of machine guns and artillery. And that became obvious from the first encounter the BEF had at the Battle of Mons in 1914. And the rest of the war really is a playing out of that theme. This is a machine-dominated war, quite different from anything the British had fought up until now.
It caught my eye, reading the book, that you don't employ once the expression, the learning curve thesis. Is that because you don't adhere to that concept as it relates to the British experience of the two world wars?
No, I think it's simplifies matters to the point, frankly, of desperation. Lessons were learnt, apparently. Then they were apparently forgotten. It's such a jerky process for the British. They learned, for example, very early in 1914 that cavalry charges against entrenched weaponry and especially machine guns is futile. They learn that, but they keep doing it. They learn that the way to demolish a trench line is to have very careful calculations of the artillery resources that you have. Then they forget it. This sort of thing happens right throughout the war until August 1918, when lessons learned at last stick. So I think describing anything as a learning curve does a great deal of disservice to what was a very flawed and jerky process.
How would you rate the top British commanders of the BEF in the Great War?
It's a good question. It's a good question that, and it's far too simple to say, to use the line led by donkeys, which came as a popular usage some years ago. These men were grappling with a war they didn't expect, a different kind of war. They got a lot of things right. I mean, Sir Douglas Haig, for example, British Commander-in-Chief from the end of 1915, got the technology in a way. He got it right. He wanted the maximum amount of artillery that he could possibly get. He welcomed new inventions like the tank and brought them into play as soon as he could. In that sense, he's doing well. Now, the problem for Haig and for most of them, though, was that they still had a 19th century attitude to the kind of battle you needed to fight. The kind of battle they were fighting was a Napoleonic one, where you broke through the enemy's lines, you rounded up their army, and you decisively defeated them in a battle or a campaign. That kind of thing ceased to be a factor in the First World War, especially on the Western Front, almost from the moment it started in 1914. By 1916, the idea of great cavalry sweeps against entrenched machine gunners, barbed wire, artillery, and all the paraphernalia of modern war is frankly obsolete. And no one on the British side in a position of high command grasps that fact firmly. General Rawlinson, for example, seems to grasp it in 1915 at the Battle of Neuve Chapelle and again when he's planning the Somme. But his grip on it is not so firm that he isn't able to instill that sort of tactic with the high command. As far as the high command concerned, Haig, General Horn, General Allenby, General Plumer, they're all of that sort of mindset. They're using 20th century technology, as it were, but in a 19th century framework, a Napoleonic framework. Haig suggests, for example, in October 1916 at the Battle of the Somme, suggests an objective 70 miles away. This is quite ridiculous. And it's only in 1918, when the British, frankly, are running out of men, that they really turn to the kind of machine war they can fight.
Would it be true to say that the Royal Navy's performance during the Great War was mildly disappointing?
It was in a way, in particular circumstances, it was. For example, let's take the Battle of Jutland, which is the most important, the largest naval battle fought by the British in the First World War. In one sense, they win that battle. Which navy is sailing around the North Sea the day after the fighting stops? It's not the German High Seas Fleet. They're in port. It's the Royal Navy. So, in a sense, they win it. There are too many ships. They have too many ships for the Germans, too many dreadnoughts. What this shows is that the dreadnought building program was brilliant in alienating Britain and absolutely futile in defeating it. Along the way, of course, they make a lot of mistakes. The battle cruiser encounters with Beatty getting his signalling wrong, the blowing up of two British battle cruisers early in the battle, followed by another one shortly afterwards, Jellicoe's failure to detect where the German fleet is towards evening, lets it sail through the end of the Grand Fleet and get home. It's not a decisive victory in that sense. And I think naval historians have lamented that fact ever since. It is, however, a decisive victory in its outcome. As I said, it's the Grand Fleet that's sailing the North Sea in the day after. What Jellicoe did might not have been heroic, but he kept the fleet in being. He kept British naval supremacy in being. The one remark Churchill makes of him in his book, The World Crisis, that he was the only man who could lose the war in an afternoon, is absolutely right. And what Jellicoe did was make sure he did not lose the war. For that, we have to thank him. On other aspects of the naval war, though, and this includes Jellicoe, the Admiralty, rather than the men at sea, were lamentably poor. They took forever to introduce convoy in for merchant ships in 1917. Though they had convoyed military ships carrying soldiers from the beginning of the war. The Australian contingent for the war, for example, was escorted in convoy by warships across the Indian Ocean, then into the Mediterranean, then into France, without losing a single person. So the idea that convoy was the way to go had been around for a long time. It took forever for Jellicoe and the admirals to realise that. The military, the Navy, are very slow to adapt to it. They think it's clumsy, that it will provide large targets for German submarines, when in fact a convoy isn't much more of a target than a single ship on the sea. And it's only in desperate circumstances, under pressure from the politicians, I might add, Lloyd George in particular, that they adopt convoy, and guess what? It works and defeats the submarine campaign. So So the Navy had a very uneven war, while overall their naval supremacy keeps Britain in the war. It's a mixed balance sheet.
Why did the debacle that was the Gallipoli campaign occur?
It's an interesting one, Gallipoli. What is happening is that the casualties on the Western Front are much more extensive than the politicians are comfortable with or are willing to live with. What they devise, and this is largely a politician-devised campaign, what they devise against the advice of their naval experts is a second front, if you will, a second front against Turkey. The idea being not that you just force the Dardanelles Straits and maybe knock Turkey out of the war. I mean, Turkey is frankly not much of a participant anyway, but that knocking Turkey out of the war gives you access to the Danube Valley, and you can attack Germany from the other side, as it were. The fact that there's only one railway up this valley and that you might have to cross the Alps to get to Germany doesn't seem to occur to them. So the idea is war on the cheap, knocking a lesser enemy out of the war, but then grappling with Germany in any way that is not the Western Front, attacking Germany from the rear. It's never going to work. There is never going to be enough soldiers. Even if there were, they couldn't be supplied. The whole idea is cockeyed, and the politicians eventually realize that and realize they have to return to the Western Front.
Why did Asquith and the rest of the cabinet allow Sir Douglas Haig to go on with the Battle of the Somme?
Yeah, that's a very good question. They're very reluctant while Haig is planning the Somme. They're reluctant to give him permission to even start the battle. They seek assurances from the Minister of Munitions, who is Lloyd George, at this point that there are enough guns to break through the German front. Lloyd George, not of course realizing how Haig is going to use his guns, says yes, the number of guns he has is unprecedented. And that plays some role in allowing the War Council to make the decision to go ahead with the Somme. When it does go ahead, this is where the puzzle really, really starts. I mean, 60,000 casualties on the first day, 20,000 dead, would you think be enough to sober any civilian leadership into thinking that this is not a good idea? That's not what happens. There's hardly any discussion in the War Council about the first day of the Somme. And what there is tends to be, well, you can't make omelets without breaking eggs, that kind of argument. The fact is, though, that the killing goes on and the politicians do nothing. The casualties on the first day of the Somme, we know well, they're 50% of the troops involved. What is not so well known is that for the rest of the Somme campaign, which lasts from July until November, the percentage casualties is exactly the same for the whole battle, 50%. What disguises that is the numbers involved in any particular day are not as big as the first day of the Somme, they're smaller. But the percentage casualties is the same, 50%, day after day after day. In August, Haig asks permission from the War Council, from the politicians, to continue the battle. And they don't even answer him. There is no answer from them at all. And Haig takes this as permission to go on, which is reasonable enough from his point of view. It's a difficult one. Asquith, in particular, is not familiar with military matters. He's never had much to do with the military in his pre-war premiership. He is reluctant to intervene, in particular, on matters of high command. He's done it once. He sacked Sir John French, who's the original leader of the BEF, and put in Sir Douglas Haig. But having put him in, it's a brave politician, I think, who would have sacked him 6 months later. And that plays a role as well. The only person who actually can work out what's going on is Winston Churchill, who realises from leaked War Office sources that the British are suffering many more casualties in the Somme than the Germans. He points this out to the War Council, who are not in the slightest interested. They just allow the battle to continue. It is one of the wonders of the age that the leaders, the liberal leaders in a liberal democracy, allow this kind of slaughter to go on for 5 months.
Would it be true to say that the BEF did not have the same morale problems that the other Great War armies had in 1917, 1918? And if that is the case, why so?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. The French indulge in what they call collective indiscipline in 1917, which is a sort of conditional mutiny. The French army will fight, but it won't attack. It'll defend, but not conduct offensives. That's the conditional mutiny. Russia, we know about utter collapse in 1917. Not, however, with the British. There are mutterings in the British Army picked up by the letter censorship during the Battle of Passchendaele in 1917 that the army is not happy with the way things are going, but it never goes any further than this. The best argument I've heard about for this is that the British armed forces are positively integrated into British society. That is, there is no great split between the military and the politicians in an existential sense. That however poorly the soldiers perceive the high commanders doing, they don't think of them in any sense as the enemy, as they clearly did in Russia and to a limited extent in France. So I think what it shows is that British society is more solid, more integrated, and perhaps this is because it is, after all, a liberal state where, although not all have the vote by any means, the feeling is that the leaders are in many ways responsible to the people.
How would you rate the BEF's performance during the Ludendorff offensives of the spring of 1918?
Yeah, this is interesting. Ludendorff, as we all know, makes colossal gains in Western Front terms in his offensives from March through to July 1918. 50 miles gained. This is cosmic in Western Front terms. Yet the BEF does not collapse. They conduct a slow and steady retreat. There is no collapse, no division of the army disintegrates. Divisions around them are disintegrating, like the poor two Portuguese divisions that happened to find themselves, for reasons I'm sure they didn't know, on the Western Front. But the British don't collapse. They retreat, and as they retreat, they are retreating onto their supply bases. They are retreating, in a sense, back to where their stores of artillery are. And the further back they go, the more solid that artillery support becomes. So there's no reason, in a sense, for them to panic. They are obtaining more firepower in their retreat then the Germans are gaining firepower in their advance. The Germans, in fact, are outrunning their artillery support, which is the factor that's allowed them to make the breakthrough in the first place. So we have an army. Yes, it's in retreat, but there is no need to panic. So the British Army does exceptionally well in the north, where they're close to the Channel ports and they need to keep the Germans away from those ports. They are solid. There's hardly a mile of retreat up there. Further south, where they're pushed back 50 miles, it doesn't particularly matter that they lose that territory. It's not vital. In fact, a lot of it is the old battleground of the Somme. And the Germans, what the Germans are doing in advancing there is inheriting a wasteland, which makes their supply of their own armies even more difficult. So the British do well in the Ludendorff offensives, even though they're pushed back.
What explains the successes of the Hundred Days campaign at the end of the Great War? By the BEF, that is.
Yeah, yeah. Look, the BEF and, look, other armies as well, the French, and I might say the Americans who fight with the British in several crucial battles in this period, have finally learnt some lessons. There is a very chilling line from Rawlinson, the commander of the Fourth Army, along the lines of, "Now we are running out of men, we must turn to machines." And this is what the British do. They're sort of forced to do it by Lloyd George, by the civilian government, who is withholding potential troops from them and keeping them in civilian employ. They're doing that for two reasons. One is that these people are needed on the home front to make tanks, machines, machine guns, artillery pieces, and ships in increasing numbers, and sending them into the army would have, in fact, deindustrialized the army. And the other thing is they're keeping them out of the hands of Haig. He can't indulge in any of the huge offensives like the Somme and Passchendaele, as he did in 1916 and 17. He's got to fight smarter now, and that's exactly what he does. And for this, he deserves some credit. The plans are devised by people below Haig, but he is quite prepared to see them carried out. So from August 1918, we don't get any grandiose offensives. We don't get any 70-mile objectives. We get objectives within the range of the artillery to support the troops. So at the Battle of Amiens, which starts on the 8th of August 1918, the initial advance of 9 or 10 miles is modest, even in terms that Ludendorff has said earlier in the year. But it's sustainable. That's the point. The tanks, the artillery can sustain the offensives because they can keep those gains in solid hands. They can put up walls of shells that the Germans cannot get through. Then, after some reorganization, you can make other advances. And what this is the first sort of modern weapons system in evolution. You've got tanks, you've got artillery, you have riflemen equipped with rifle grenades, light machine guns, Lewis guns, heavy machine guns in greater numbers than you've ever had before. And you are now using them in combination with each other. So it is now a weapons system. The Germans never develop anything like this on their side of the front. So these gains, small gains, each one of them, August, September, they're not huge. But when they get to the German defensive lines, they use the weight of weaponry, the weight of artillery, a million shells in 24 hours to break down those defensive lines. So it's also a matter of supply. And this is where the Americans come into the picture. Not so much as fighters, although they are important in helping to break the Hindenburg Line in September 1918. There are two American divisions there. Where the Americans are important is supplying the British with money in ever-increasing amounts, so that the Ministry of Munitions in Britain is the largest munitions works in the world and the most efficient. And that's some story, because in 1914, the British Army had virtually no munitions works at all. They had a couple of firms, Vickers Armstrong and the like, working for them, but no industry. Now they have millions in the munitions industry supplying them with these shells, tanks and guns that enables them to break the deadlock finally on the Western Front.
Why did British foreign policy in the interwar period eventually devolve into the policy of appeasement?
There was a great feeling, especially in from the late 20s in the early 30s, of never again. Never the Western Front again, never the killing fields in France and Flanders again. This has given a great boost as people's memoirs from the First World War start to come into prominence. I'm thinking here of books by Robert Graves, Goodbye to All That, Siegfried Sassoon, Memoirs of an Infantry Officer, and many others, Richard Aldington, Death of a Hero, and so on. There is a gradual revulsion about what's happened in 1918, and a gradual forgetting of why the war was fought in the first place, to prevent German expansion. This feeling of never again takes over in the early 30s in Britain, and is intensified by the prospect of a new war with new weaponry. One of the key speeches of the 1930s is made by Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, who says, whatever we do, whatever we devise, the bomber will always get through. And you get stories and films by H.G. Wells showing cities absolutely flattened by bombing. And in particular, it's no secret that most of these cities are in fact London. And a fat tethered cow in Churchill's phrase. And this increases the revulsion. A war fought now with modern weaponry, and particularly modern bombers, is going to be much more horrific, people think, even than the First World War. So we must move to stop it. How can we do that? Well, we must strike a deal with Germany. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, except the guy you're trying to strike a deal with is Adolf Hitler, between whom deals cannot be struck. You might come to an arrangement with Hitler, but when it suits him, he will break it. And this is the story, the sad story of appeasement from about 1935.
Why do you mostly absolve Churchill of blame for the debacle, or the fiasco, I should say, of the Norway campaign of 1940?
Yeah, Churchill is in a difficult position here. He doesn't do well. The landings in Norway are in some ways reminiscent of the Dardanelles. They're poorly thought out. They're poorly organized. Nobody knows where the supplies are going. Often the supplies go to elsewhere than where the troops are. It's a difficult position. But Churchill is not Prime Minister. He's First Lord of the Admiralty. There's a huge difference of trying to run the war, which frankly Churchill is trying to do, from a subordinate position than one running it as Prime Minister. He can't do everything that he'd like to do. He has to get Chamberlain's approval for that. They form a couple of other extraneous bodies, which Churchill chairs, but he can't get decisions. He has to invite Chamberlain to those meetings. The meetings dissolve into absolute indecision, as Chamberlain basically can't decide whether he wants to fight this war to the knife or not. So Churchill is responsible for a few things that go wrong in Norway, but he's not ultimately responsible because he's not ultimately in charge.
Why do the RFA win and the Luftwaffe lose the Battle of Britain?
Yeah, this goes back to the mid-30s and the invention of radar. The radar chain around Britain is absolutely crucial in the decision for the Battle of Britain. It enables Britain to have an early warning, not much of a one, because the Luftwaffe are just across the Straits of Dover. Not much of a warning, but enough to get planes into the sky in time to meet them. Now, the planes that do get into the sky are good. They're excellent planes, again, designed in the mid-30s, the Hurricane, which is the main plane in the Battle of Britain, and, of course, the better-known Spitfire. These are the equal of anything the Germans have got, the Messerschmitt 109. These planes are the equal of them, and they're more than the equal, of course, of the slower and fairly lightly armed German bombers. Now, what you need for this system to work are commanders that know what they're doing. And luckily for Britain, in 1940, they have such commanders. They have Hugh Dowding, head of fighter command, and they have Sir Keith Park, who was actually born in New Zealand, but is in charge of 11 Group, that is the one based at Uxbridge, that is defending London and the airports to its south. And the tactics these people devise is to send up not everything they've got to meet the Luftwaffe, but enough to break up the German bomber stream. So that what they're doing is committing just a small fraction of fighter command, which only has at this point about 750 single-engine fighters. Not a lot. But Park and Dowding devise these tactics, miserly tactics, of sending 20, 30, 50 planes against many more that the Luftwaffe send over, and find that they can break up the bomber stream, which induces inaccurate bombing from pretty light bomb loads, it has to be said. 3,000 or 4,000 pounds is all these German two-engine planes can carry. They are, in a sense, not strategic bombers trying to carry out a strategic offensive. Yes, they can damage airfields, but when they start dropping their bombs on London, it's too big a target for the kind of bomb loads that they have. So it's Park, Sir Keith Park and Hugh Dowding that devise this strategy, and they stick to it right through the battle. Always in the battle, the British have a reserve of planes, and they have them in the north of England and Scotland. They can be called upon at any time, but they're not called on very often. They're the reserve if things start to go belly up further south. And they're kept out of the day-to-day fighting while 11 Group under Park does most of the work. So at the end of the battle, the British have more single-engine planes than they began with. They have over 1,000.
In the context of the North African campaign, why were Wavell and Auchinleck failures as commanders and Montgomery a success?
Yeah, I mean, Wavell starts off doing particularly well. He routs the Italian 10th Army in 1940 and 41, virtually destroys it. he's using tactics that are not unfamiliar to those who study the battles of 1918. Tobruk, for example, which he captures from the Italians, is the result of a mass artillery bombardment with troops following a creeping barrage behind, close behind it, who overwhelmed the Italian defences. The difficulty comes when you get an opponent with better weaponry and a more savvy way of fighting the war, which, of course, you do when Rommel and the Afrika Korps arrive in North Africa. Rommel has this reputation for dashing about the desert in tanks. He actually doesn't. What he does is lure the British onto his tanks, often dug in the sand, and often accompanied by anti-tank guns, including the devastating 88mm gun. The British tanks can't survive this sort of thing. And it's rather the British who go dashing about the desert in tanks. Maybe this comes from the fact that when Britain created its tank force, it did it by mechanizing the cavalry. That is, most of the commanders in the desert during this period were cavalry officers in their early days, and they're behaving in their groups of tanks as though they're in a cavalry charge. The problem here is they're charging anti-tank guns and dug-in tanks, and usually disastrously. The British response to these early reverses from Rommel is to decentralise their fighting force even further. They develop armoured columns, small groups of tanks, artillery and infantry that try and outflank Rommel at various points. The problem is these columns are not strong enough actually to be successful anywhere. What's happening is that Rommel is enabled, by keeping his tanks and guns together, he's able to pick these columns off one at a time. This happens under Wavell, and it's intensified under General Auchinleck. Now, Auchinleck is a clever commander, but he's gone down the wrong path in all this. He's a weight of material, and sometimes enables him to succeed. Operation Crusader is a sort of British success, but the British lose so much stuff in fighting that battle in 1942 that Rommel is able to counterattack quite quickly and gain back all the territory he's lost. From then on, the British decentralisation gets worse and worse and worse. They have what's called brigade boxes all scattered all over the desert. They're not mutually supporting, so again, Rommel can pick them off one after the other. In the end, Churchill and Allenbrooke, back in London, chiefs of general staff, have had enough of this. They go out to the desert, and there's a certain amount of irony here, because the person Churchill wants to appoint, General Gott, is one of those who've decentralised the Eighth Army. He's responsible for these brigade boxes, which Rommel can deal with quite well. What happens, though, is Gott, on his way to take up his post as commander of the Eighth Army, is killed in an air crash, and Montgomery is flown out from England to do the job. Now, what the difference between Montgomery and the earlier desert commanders is that Montgomery is a centralizer. Rather than dispersing his firepower, he unites it. The artillery will now act as one, 600 or so guns. The tanks will not go dashing about all over the desert. They will be very cautious in their approach. In fact, at Montgomery's signature battle at Alamein, the infantry pick their way through the minefields to clear a way for the armour, not the other way round. And of course, the British have better armor now. Churchill is actually in Washington when one of the disasters of Auchinleck has presided over comes through. They've lost a huge amount of tanks. And President Roosevelt and General Marshall immediately offer the British 300 of their newest tanks, the Sherman tank, which is a better tank than the British have ever had in the desert before. And they're used at Alamein, a good example of inter-allied cooperation there, because these tanks were designed to go to US units, which were waiting for them. Instead, they go to the British, they go to the Western Desert, and they help win the Battle of Alamein. But the main reason Alamein is won is that Montgomery centralizes everything on himself and his staff, who are super, super confident and super efficient. Alamein opens with the largest artillery bombardment seen, I suspect, since 1918. It blasts away at the Germans, and Montgomery keeps at it. There will be no decentralization, no columns dashing about under him. It will be centralized in his headquarters. That eventually, what Montgomery's doing actually is fighting a battle of attrition at Alamein, though he dare not use that word after the First World War. Attrition is not to be used, but that's what he's doing. And gradually he crumbles away the Africa Corps' defences and forces Rommel into a retreat, which Montgomery cautiously follows up, not wanting to this back and forth across the desert that you've had for the last 2 years. This time, when Rommel retreats, it's permanent.
Would it be true to say that you do not quite agree with Jonathan Fennell's highlighting the importance of morale to the African campaign in particular and the British experience of the Second World War in general?
Look, that's an amazingly important book by Jonathan Fennell. And he highlights the fluctuations in British morale, which certainly go up and down. I think my point is, despite these fluctuations in morale, the British keep fighting. I think Jonathan has got it absolutely right. In Singapore, morale falls to such an extent there that the army basically disintegrates, though there are plenty of military reasons why that's the case. In North Africa, I'm sure he's right in all this. I'm sure British morale before Alamein was pretty low. The fact is, though, they kept on fighting. And what that shows is that you can fight with low morale sometimes as well as you can with high morale. Same applies to the Blitz in some ways. People keep talking about how British morale dropped during the Blitz. The fact is, it'd be surprising if it didn't. If you're being bombed every night from the sky, why wouldn't your morale drop? On the other hand, if you're prepared to get up in the morning and go to work, then to what extent is morale a key factor, and to what extent is tenacity a factor? That's, I think, the only area where I disagree with that book, which I admire pretty much.
Do you agree with Fennell that in the same book that due to various deficiencies, the British Army for the most of the war was incapable of complex tactics and maneuvers as, say, the Germans were?
Yeah, I suppose I differ a little in that I don't think the British, that's the way the British fight best. I think Montgomery discovered the way they fight best. And that is with non-spectacular actions. We've talked of Alamein, but we can also talk about Normandy in this context. None of the British battles fought in Normandy are spectacularly successful. We have Epsom, we have Charnwood, we have Goodwood, Bluecoat, and all the rest of them. none of them get very far, but they are doing the job that Montgomery wants done, and that is wearing down the Germans, pinning them to the British flank, while the Americans can do much greater manoeuvres on the right. It's, I think, the way the British fight their wars best. I mean, what this reminds me of, especially Normandy, is Grant's campaign in 1864-5, Petersburg, Wilderness, Spotsylvania, and the like. Every time Grant sort of loses, he advances. Every time Montgomery doesn't get anywhere, he wears the Germans down just that little bit more. Eventually, he's worn them down to the extent that they collapse. German casualties in the Normandy campaign are just about 500,000. The army is disintegrated by the end of that campaign. And that campaign, I might add, it lasted just 11 weeks from June the 6th until August the 20th or 22nd. The German army is finished off in the West, and the British have played a considerable role in that, as of course have the Americans, in bringing that about by, until the end, pretty unspectacular campaigns. Now, the only spectacular campaign in the whole Normandy operation is really Cobra and Patton's exploitation of Cobra. But the wearing down has been done by Montgomery and Bradley in fairly ordinary, unflashy, unmaneuverable circumstances. But they've done the job nonetheless.
In Lord Moran's diaries, there are various comments by people like Field Marshal Alexander, as well as Churchill, to the effect that the average British soldier of the Second World War was not quite up to the level of the Great War vintage British soldier. Do you agree?
I think they're different specimens altogether. The difference that allowed battles like the Somme to take place, the unthinking obedience to instruction that needed, a campaign like that needed, had gone by the time of the Second World War. Partly it had gone because of a change of attitude from the local, from the population. Partly it had gone because the British leadership in the Second World War realized that you could not fight First World War battles during the Second World War. Once was enough, or indeed too much. Twice was unthinkable. So the battles had to be fought in different ways in the Second World War. And they had to be fought, especially if you're British, with a casualty list always in mind. And the British Army is running out of men actually before the Normandy invasion in 1944. You can't fight a battle like the Somme in those sort of conditions. Britain is wishing to preserve its army to the extent it can, to cut some figure at a peace conference, which everybody thought would happen in 1945. So comparing the soldiers is very difficult. There are technological explanations, military explanations for why the British fail in 1941 and 42 to win many of their battles, rather than looking at the men and saying they're deficient. Though you're quite right, Moran, Alexander, Brooke, even, and Churchill at times, thinks that they're not up to the same kind of battle. But the fact is, the same kind of battle isn't being fought. It's being fought much more with machines. The key arm in the British Army is that key arm that won them those victories in 1918. It's the artillery. It is the most superior of the British arms. in the Army and possibly in the American Army as well, actually. The British are able to use their artillery much more flexibly than the Germans. They're enabled to bring firepower down of an enormous kind, sometimes an entire army on a single target. The Germans never developed that sort of thing. And the British have learnt in that extent the lessons of 1918 and those victorious battles from Amiens on. So I don't think it's all that helpful comparing the soldiers of one war with those of another when they are, in fact, in the West fighting a different kind of war.
Do you agree with those such as Sir Max Hastings, who posit that the average British and indeed American soldier of the Second World War was not as good as his German opposite number?
Yeah, no, I agree with Max Hastings on a lot of things, but not that. I'm looking, in my latest work, I'm looking at the Normandy campaign, and I'm not finding any evidence to support that. I know people have said the Germans have the best tanks, best machine guns, and so on in that campaign, better than the Americans, better than the British. But to me, the British and the Americans are able to outmaneuver the Germans time after time. I mean, we've got to keep this in mind. Keep that 11-week period in mind. It takes just 11 weeks from June the 6th for the Allied armies in Normandy to smash the German opponents. That's not bad going. 77 days and you've destroyed the German army in the West. You must be doing something right to be able to do that, to say the least. And what I intend to do in this further work is to investigate that issue that you raise, which is pervasive throughout the literature, and come to some more definite conclusions. But my interim conclusions are that I would disagree with Max Hastings on that point.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Professor, what would it be?
It would be, I think, the primacy in liberal states, in democratic states, the primacy of the politicians. They are the ones ultimately responsible to the people for how the war is conducted. And if that means they have to keep sacking generals until they find ones that can win them the war, then that's what it means. Churchill is often criticized for sacking too many generals in the Second World War. You could argue, though, that the political leadership in Britain in the First World War didn't sack enough. The great sacker of generals, Abraham Lincoln, knew what he was doing. In that sense, he kept sacking them until he found one, Ulysses Grant. So the big takeaway to me is that politicians must be prime in any war conducted by a democratic state. And in Britain, that was the case in both wars.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Pryor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you very much, Professor Pryor.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you.